You can't think outside of the box if you don't know what the box is, because your adversary, your enemy, kind of has a rough idea what your box is too, right, if they're paying attention. What is material different is what the threat can do to you. So you're going to have to act differently. You're going to have to do things differently. But those tasks that you're expected to do, like deliver a defense and limit the contact, you're still going to have to do those.
Greetings and welcome to the Operational March, the official podcast of the School of Advanced Military Studies, dedicated to bridging the gap between tactics and strategy through the study of operational art and the operational level of war. Our guest today is Colonel Retired Rich Creek, the director of the U.S. Army's Combined Arms Doctrine Directorate, or CAD, at Fort Leavenworth. While serving, Colonel Creed was an armor officer and commanded at the company, battalion, and brigade levels. He is a 2002 graduate of the Advanced Military Studies Program at SAMS and a 2011 graduate of the U.S. Army War College. Welcome to our show today, sir. Thanks for taking time to talk to us.
Hey, it's a real pleasure to be here.
You are our third episode in this limited series we're running on the pillars of operational art. We're going to talk today a little bit about doctrine and doctrine's role in informing the operational artist and generating sound operational art. We've had an opportunity to talk to Dr. Nowitzki at the Art of War Scholars Program about history, talk to Dr. Gorman at the ASLSP program about theory, and you as the director of CAD, we thought was a good fit for the conversation on doctrine, which we think occupies a unique place within what we might define as the trinity of the pillars, theory, doctrine, and history. But as we always do, we have a token question we start with.
Sure.
So if you wouldn't mind, sir, providing for us kind of what your personal definition of theory of operational art is.
Well, as Dr. Mann, I'm not going to be very much the same as perhaps some of your other guests have been. I'm just going to use the doctrinal definition of it, right? We played a spent a lot of time thinking about that. And it's a pretty simple definition because it's the expected an Einstein idea, right? You can't explain it to your mom, you really don't understand it. And so we talk about in terms of pursuit of strategic objectives in whole or in part through the arrangement of tactical actions in time, space, and purpose, right? And you do that in a specific context. So the definition we use, that I use, that I'm most comfortable with is the doctrinal definition. It's in Army Doctrinal Publication 3.0. I don't think we have it in the current 3.0 because we address that level of doctrine that's very broad and fundamental to our profession at that ADP level or the Army Doctrinal Publication level. What's interesting, I think, and I think it's a whole lot of swing, doctrinally, quite frankly, is that we don't have a techniques publication that's dedicated to operational art. And so Dr. Greer, Jim Greer, one of your SAMS faculty over there, who was my SAMS director way back when, we had a conversation about that. And we think that there would be great utility in the Army if we came up with an ATP that just described operational art. And so while we talk about operational art broadly in terms of its components and what you use it for and so forth, we don't really help people think through that from a doctoral perspective. We depend on the schoolhouse, SAMS primarily, the 59 course up at Carlisle helps with that as we develop strategies. But they're really focused up at a, you know, it's in the name, right, strategy. So I think of operational art in terms of it's the skill set that's variable amongst human beings. That's the art piece, right? And it's your ability to devise operational approaches as part of a staff on behalf of commanders in a specific context to achieve specific objectives. And so reconciling those strategic objectives with the means available, because we're in the means business, right? The means and ways, that's really where it comes in. And so there's those infinite combinations informed by constraints and restrictions, right, in any particular situation. But it's what distinguishes people who have thought deeply about what it is that you want Army forces to do, or even the Joint Force, and people who are more functionally oriented in terms of, I'm just, you know, I'm working on inbox issues and I'm just taking care of knocking out tasks. You need people who look at the entirety of the situation and then can devise usually more than one possibility, right? And so it gets into what are the possibilities that the enemy is least likely to be able to counter or least likely to expect, or both.
Looking past the doctrinal definition and the whole of the dearth of doctrine that is published for the army, kind of juxtaposed against theory and history's roles to provide a baseline summary of what our other guests who discussed those topics offered us. The role of history is to provide some historical anecdote and context to the current situation. Theory gives us the capability to make sense of what is otherwise complicated. Make sense of the world, I think, is how Dr. Coleman put it.
Sure.
How would you look at the role of doctrine as a whole in conducting operational work?
Yeah, so what it does is it provides this common language, right? So I don't need to explain everything. If you have, so people like to talk about connecting dots, right? And thinking outside the box. And people use that, depending on what era we're in, a little bit too often, right? And they don't emphasize, one, having a large number of dots in your head, or having access to those dots, and then knowing where the box is. And so, you can't think outside of the box if you don't know what the box is, because your adversary or your enemy kind of has a rough idea what your box is too, right? If they're paying attention, if they're doing their own threat-informed decision-making. But it's first and foremost a common language. And you need to have a vocabulary that's rather significant if you're going to be an operational artist, much more than being a tactician, right? But you can't be an operational artist if you don't understand tactics. And you can't be an operational artist if you're not a good one, if you don't understand at least the rudiments of strategy, or at least the strategy that you are trying to implement during the conduct of the operation that you're planning. And so doctrine gives us things like operation variables, mission variables. It gives us the operations process to inform the military decision-making model or operational design, both options, right? And that's where context matters. What I've found is that we've often run into people, and it happens all the time, people will call the Combined Arms Center commander, the trade-out commander, usually a senior person, I'll say, how come doctrine doesn't address this? And then somebody gives me a call, shoots me down, hey, Rich, somebody called and said that we don't have any doctrine on this. I think we do. Can you check and ask somebody in 10 minutes? They'll send me, excerpts of the very topic that they had with the definition and the description and all the rest of it. I don't think it's ever occurred once that somebody said something that was hot, something that was new, wasn't actually already in doctrine. It's a pretty mature body of professional knowledge. What's interesting, I think, is a lot of things that are new to somebody because they're in a new duty position or they're in a different environment for a change, it's new to them. But it's not new to the collective memory of the institution. It may be in the practical memory or the experience of the people currently serving in the institution, our army, but pretty much every doctrinal idea is rooted in the experience of either the current force or the forces that preceded us. We just choose to emphasize different things in different times and places. So, how do you reconcile that? Well, one, nobody's going to be a doctrinal expert. I'm not a doctrine expert, right? None of my people are doctrine experts in the sense that they know everything about everything. They're expert in things that are related to what we ask of them to do. And so that broad experience, that diversity of experience only gets you so far because you're one person, right? But we don't practice operational art by ourselves. That's a team sport. So all the other people that are helping you devise an operational approach, for example, bring their own experience and opinions to bear. But I think you can't address the doctrine without a rudimentary understanding of theory, right? Not that you have to have your own personal theory, but you should be relatively familiar, even if you can't name all the details of why you know something. Oftentimes it's because you had a class on theory. The history piece, though, is really fascinating because people with a broad understanding of military history in particular have more dots to connect than everybody else, right? And the SAM's education, one of the things that makes SAM's different than everywhere else other than the emphasis on theory, doctrine, and history is really the volume at which you absorb that stuff over the course. course of the year. And you're just doing a lot more reading than everybody else. And it's reading that's focused on the professional arms and to become ultimately an operational artist. I also think that operational art is something that, you know, you don't dabble in just because you're in a duty position, right? So, you know, I'm the division planner for the G3 shop. Well, you would hope that your G3 has some understanding of operational art, and, you know, typically they are. And typically, they're former salespeople, too. But you've got that echelon of experience over time with a common understanding of operational art, even if there's variables in those backgrounds. Actually, those variables and variations in experience over time are what allows you to come to better answers. And so rank in a hierarchical institution like Army, yeah, you've got to get guidance top down. But the expectation is that you are providing value bottom up in terms of, hey, boss, did you think about this? Did you think about that? Hey, I can't remember exactly where some typical or similar operation was being conducted in the past, but I know that you have to take these things into account. If I go back to my hooch for the night, I'll remember what it was. I'll probably be able to pull up the book on my Kindle or something. I found that the longer and the more engaged you are in operational art in terms of the things you choose to read and expose yourself to, the more valuable you are to the institution. Again, it's not that you're an expert. It's more that you're a generalist. With a layperson might think it's real expertise, but we all know what real experts look like on a particular field, right? And someone who's a singular subject matter expert on something is useful in terms of operational art, but not useful in being as an operational artist themselves. You need a generalist to be able to. I don't know if I answered the question. I was probably all over the place there, but.
No, I think you touched on a few things that Dan and I talk about. I think that most people would only describe themselves as an expert in a very few number of things.
Right.
You know, at one time in my career, I was an expert at land map.
Right.
Probably not an expert in it anymore, but I still remember how not to get lost in the woods.
Sure.
I know Dan's coming up a bit because I know you walked right into one of his spider webs.
There we go. Well, I don't know if it would be a spider web, but it is funny you say that, right? Like, the more you know, the more you realize you don't know. Like, people who joke and say, hey, Dan, you're an expert in Napoleonics. Like, no, I know what a dude or dudette in Napoleonics expert looks like, and I am not there. So this is an interesting concept of the more you know, the more you realize you don't know. But as far as, like, the institutional knowledge that Doctrine provides, and you guys here have a very, you know, unique responsibility of what we emphasize and what we don't emphasize based on the challenges that we foresee for the future Army and the future force. I was just interested in the, like, risk proposition of choosing what to emphasize and or when you do a dynamic shift and you change the, you know, the diction that you're using in Doctrine, the gap that then ensues, right, that FM2-0 for NTAS, C3-0, so there'll be, like, an institutional gap. Is there, like, a risk calculus that goes into that at all, or is there a conversation in all those varying pieces, right? Because 3-0 would be the center, the nucleus, right, that everything else has to revolve around.
Yeah, I think there are risk discussions, right? And really, where the Army leadership decides to focus is largely informed by the operational environment writ large at the geostrategic level. And so they're looking at risk in terms of most likely versus most dangerous types of operations or conflicts, you know, because we're in the conflict business. So ultimately, we provide forces organized, trained, and equipped to conduct cross sustained land combat for joint force commanders. So, what's the worst day possible look like? And then you kind of move backwards from there. So, when we made the decision, we being the Army made the decision, it wasn't like they called a meeting and said, all right, guys, we are now shifting direction here. It was a series of conversations between the CAC commander, the TRADOC commander at the time, the Army Chief of Staff, the TRADOC G2, who was responsible for the threat description for the whole Army, right? They're the ones that do that. And over time, you had, you know, real-world events that kind of accumulated that caused people to say, hey, you know, we need to probably start thinking about when was the last time we looked at that. And those conversations are very revealing, because then they come and ask, what do we say about this? Is our doctrine adequate for a different kind of focus? And when the answer is no, and almost always the answer is going to be no, because that shift in focus means you've neglected something for some period of time. And so it's going to be out of date to a certain extent. The fundamentals don't change very much, but the details do. And so how do you mitigate that risk, of a significant shift? Well, doctrine helps you mitigate the risk in some ways, because doctrine is where you store experience. The collective experience of the United States Army is stored in doctrine, because we're an up-and-out formation, right? So you go to any brigade right now, and what, 70-80% of the people have no deployment patches on their right shoulder. I don't call them combat patches, because in most cases, they're not combat patches. Even in the height of the war, most of the patches weren't actually combat patches. They were deployment patches in a dangerous place. And that's not imputing anybody's patriotism, fidelity, or valor at all. It's just that's the way it is. And so I'm going to give you an example. There's a good friend of mine who was also a SAMS grad, and he went to AMSLP, at the War College Fellowship there. He was a brigade commander down at Fort Jackson, right? And they were training basic combat tactics to trainees, that squad level stuff, very rudimentary stuff. And they were using counterinsurgency, room clearing kind of stuff, and crossing streets in a certain way. All things that we did in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he was like, you guys need to stop doing it. That's not what I'm teaching you here to do. We're teaching you infantry, basic infantry tactics, not coin tactics. And then he got this pushback from all the drill sergeants, or a lot of the drill sergeants. Nah, that's not how we do it in the real world. And he's like, all right, let's have a conversation here. So he had all the drill sergeants in his brigade in an auditorium down in Jackson. And he said, who here deploy? Everybody stands up. All right, so when you can't answer the question, I want you to sit down. If the answer is not yes, then you sit down. Who was fired on by the enemy? Who heard bullets going by? Their ears. A quarter of the people sat down. Who engaged the enemy using infantry tactics, in a small unit fight in close combat on your own terms? In other words, you set the conditions for that as opposed to a reaction to an ambush. And then we like three people left standing. I said, so let's take a humility test here. The tactics that are described in our infantry manuals in the doctrine were based on hard-learned lessons from the First World War, Second World War, Korean War, Vietnam War, Gulf War, and so forth, right? And that's why we do those things, right? Because that's what running looks like. You can adapt later to unique conditions, but teach people the right way first. And that was him using doctrine to make a point to people who assumed that they knew everything because of their relatively narrow experience.
Yeah, but yeah, it's...
But it gets to the what you said, the longer you're in the Army, right, the more, or in any profession, and we're in a profession, your humility should increase because you realize the more you know, the less you know.
I was thinking of it made me think of the harsh criticism of this idea of MDO. You're like, oh, now we're creating coin. And maybe as a lieutenant captain, I would have fell in that crowd. But now, if I'm being reflective about it, really it's the individual onus to understand, their best practices, but also keep up with the basics, right? You have to re-zero. You have to foresight eventually, right? You just can't keep firing rounds. And this idea that the Army has an obligation of this new generation of soldiers coming in who don't have that experience to lean on, need to be re-foresighted. And instead of hunting the responsibility, we'll say, of coin to get codified in doctrine as the thing we do, you could make a very compelling argument that would be the individual responsibility, right, to branch out and to learn once you have recentered on your basics, right?
Yeah, I think that's, to a certain extent, that's very correct. And we talk, and you guys heard me probably over at the college when we were talking about, subject matter expertise. For example, I branch in MOS, which is got a training component, but it's got a very specific doctrinal component. That is something that we are now, once again, valuing to a very high extent across all branches and MOSs, and not just everybody kind of contributing to a specific team sport, like coin or stability or something. We actually need transportation officers who know transportation. We need tankers who are expert gunnery, right, and at small unit tactics. We need air defenders that understand shore rat and not just patriot, even though you never really got a chance to do shore rat perhaps in your career or very often. And I think those are all examples of, again, this intellectual humility that we all need to have. And I guess the other thing with experience, and again, experience is important, but something that you did as a captain, if you were a two-star general, you spent 20 years doing something else, and then you come back to something, and you're better able to visualize it than people that haven't, you know, grown up in an army like that. There's no doubt about it. But you weren't a division commander. You were a company commander. And so what do you need to do? And I think from the doctrinal perspective, one thing that we always tried to do is we refocused on large-scale combat operations, right? That's a worst-case scenario, and you want to take a multi-domain approach to that. You know, one of the things we do routinely is we go back to the last edition of a book that was focused the same way. And that's the point of the push. Not what we have now. Go back to when you had people who were, no kidding, division and corps commanders fighting the Germans and Japanese or the North Vietnamese or the North Koreans and Chinese, right? That doctrine was written by people and reviewed by people and approved by people that actually did those things. So start there and then pull it up.
There's two big topics we'd really like to go for, and you've opened the door to both of them.
Sure.
So I'm gonna posit to you a theory.
Sure.
One could argue that the first time a force conducted multi-domain operations was the first time a nation put a soldier's foot on a boat. We introduced a new domain the first time that happened. And then we could layer onto that kind of the thought that we have some seminal theorists that we always kind of go back to. There's if you read 3.0, you're going to see Clausewitz, you're going to see a little bit of Chomini. One might argue, you might see some Foch. Dan would not argue that, but I might.
I would hope you'd see a lot of Foch.
You have a lot of Foch too.
Yeah, there's some Foch too in there. There's the people we know we're going to see, but it's really just, we're really just kind of going back to deep battle across domains. So if deep battle is the massing of combat power at a specific weak point along an enemy's echelon front in order to penetrate into the deep area, striking strategic targets in the rear. Convergence is just kind of doing that across domains. It's kind of the difference between what I might define as synchronization. Synchronization gives me good deep battle, which is where we get air land battle from. It's where we probably get a little bit of unifying land operations from. You see that in historic campaigns of the army post the introduction to those doctrine. And then we go towards coin. And now we're reorienting ourselves towards LISCO, and the best theory that was executed by forces that conducted those operations, to kind of key on what you're saying, was deep battle.
Yeah, I think you're on track. So before we published the 3.0 in October, we had a pretty long lead up for that, right? So they published multi-domain battle back in 2016. Actually, it was a white paper with some slides, but it became NDO and it was published in December 18th. No operational concept in Army history has been telegraphed longer than this one, right? I mean, this play's been coming. Everybody knows that we're running right on this. And so it was done in parallel with the refocus on large-scale combat operations, and it was devised for a very specific purpose. And it was a purpose designed to meet the needs of the nation. But to your other point, you know, during that big lead up, when I would get up in front of people and talk about the focus on LISCO and a multi-domain understanding of the world around us, I pointed out things just to defuse the critics, because we've been dealing with that on the blogosphere for a long time. Maritime operations have influenced operations on land for 3,000 years at least, right? Air since observation balloons in the 19th century, EMS for 120 years, so you can say cyber for 25 plus. But the larger EMS is a part of that multi-domain approach. Space since the 60s. And so all of those things are true. We've been a multi-domain force since at least the Second World War. Okay. We just chose not to use the words domain, right? Domain kind last, you know, 15 years or so. The purpose of each service is to create expertise specialists who are capable of focused operations in a particular domain. That's why you have Air Force, you have Navy, you have Space Force, and we have a Cyber Force in the former U.S. Cyber Command. But each of those services are inherently multi-domain already, just like us focused on operations on land. There's been air considerations, cyber considerations, space considerations, and maritime considerations, although maritime is the one that hasn't really come into play very much since Vietnam, and at large scale, not since the Second World War. So when we looked at this, one of the first things that we talked about with General Lundy was the multi-domain extended battlefield. That's this idea. It takes the extended battlefield that General Story talked about with airland battle, which, oh, by the way, is a multi-domain concept. It's right in the name, airland battle. But that was always designed to be part of the larger joint approach to operations, right? So that hasn't changed. So just because we focused on full-spectrum operations for a while, that acknowledges that the Army does win those, right? It's not all about the big wars against big opponents. There's those traditional things that the U.S. Army's always been expected to be able to do. And really, we've been doing it since 1758. And then you go, okay, so where are we at now? Well, we're at Unified Land Operations. Well, what's that? Well, it's the Army's contribution to unified action. Well, okay, what's that? Well, it means that when you go to conduct operations, it's a conflict is inherently a whole of government approach. And you do it with allies and partners. You do it with other types of U.S. governmental agencies and so forth. Plus, again, you're still part of the joint force. So each of these concepts built upon one another and focus on different things over different times, but none of that original stuff ever disappeared, right? This idea of deep operations and creating dilemmas through the depth and breadth of the enemy's air, that was always undergirding the thinking of people because as the Army evolved, the most senior people still were familiar with those things. Now, you get into a strange situation where, again, if you were commissioned after 2001 when full-spectrum operations became the thing, airland battle is like talking to somebody about, you know, I remember back in the day, you know, I was knee deep in grenade pits, and then people are looking at you like, what are you talking about? And we did deliberately try to make a parallel between NDO and airland battle, but a lot of that has to do with the same type of urgency for modernization, right, and readiness as much as anything else. Because we're not trying to build an army to do airland battle. We're trying to build an army to conduct operations in the 21st, multipolar, technologically advanced or more technologically advanced kind of world. And so we couldn't just dust off airland battle, call it airland battle 2, although some people were calling it that. We actually called the 2017-30 NDO-1, is what it was. We just weren't ready to adopt it as a concept because we hadn't played around with it or thought about it for long enough. But there are some very different things, even as there are similarities. And the differences really get to that strategic situation that the local army forces find themselves in, and what types of fights you can anticipate happening against the Russia, China, North Korea, or Iran. And they're in no way, shape, or form anything like battle in the Central German Plains in 1986 or defending the Korean Peninsula in 1999. It's just a very different type of world that we live in. So when we run into people that say, hey, well, that's not new, then you're right, it's not. And we're not trying to say it is. We've got a concept that is new, but most of the components of that concept have been with us for a very long time. They've just manifested themselves maybe a little bit different. Some of them at the lower tactical levels are no different at all. You know, the brigade command team, combat team and below type fight, it's not materially different than it ever was in recent history. What is materially different is what the threat can do to you. So you're going to have to act differently. You're going to have to do things differently. But those tasks that you're expected to do, like deliver a defense and move it to contact, you're still going to have to do those.
Right.
They're not a multi-domain move it to contact, right? We're not going to go out and do a multi-domain deliberate defense. No, you're just going to go out and do a defense that you're being continuously watched,
right?
And that you're dealing with somebody that if they find you and they consider you a lucrative target, they can kill you, which is completely different for the majority of the Army that's with the 98% of the Army that's enlisted or been commissioned since 2001, right? you got to deal with a world where people can do things to you with impunity, that do things to us that we've been doing to other people with impunity for 30-something years. That's a very different world. And it needs a different doctrinal emphasis, and it needs a different way of thinking about our business, which, again, gets you back to that operational heart.
So we all have our, I guess, pet projects or pet ideas that we grapple with before we go to bed at night. So, you know, all models are wrong, some are useful, right?
Right.
So new doctrine right now lays out a new definition or redefines the elements of combat power. The definition of combat power hasn't changed. I always have this cognitive struggle, being an intel guy, being a former armor guy, leaned on heavily when we do co-analysis wargaming, and the lack of tools provided by doctrine currently as it sits on how to effectively run a war game with qualitative analysis. And, you know, the first reaction is like, hey, we don't do enough in doctrine. Second reaction is, well, what is the appropriate amount of best practices that doctrine provides? Is the FM the best avenue? Is the ADP the best avenue? Like, so I was wondering on your thoughts on that. And when you guys, you know, doing a big doctrine rewrite 3.0, and you got somebody grinding on combat power, at what point do you got to tell them to cut sling load that, you know, this is good enough for this larger document, and it can be discussed further in further documents or advancing the conversation, right?
If I could tag on a little bit, that brigade commander can look at the arrayed forces in front of her and say, all right, I know what your T-72s are going to do, I know what your HIMARS are going to do, but they have to account for those other domains and how they change that calculation. That is what I think about when Dan brings this up on a daily basis at exactly 1300 after we've had lunch and he said, have this do on it.
Because it's hard because it's no longer like systems fighting, right? You can't just do 3-1, 4-1. That what goes into those ratios becomes very complex.
Army used to have tools for being correlation of forces analysis and whatever the other acronym COFINS used to stand for. I always forget. Correlation of forces model.
Yeah.
So we had pretty well developed based on everything that was a Soviet style or anybody that had Soviet style stuff. So we did wrestle with this, and one reason why we decided we were going to wrestle with it, nobody told us to, but there were two things going on simultaneously that were causes for concern. The first was the old definition, the Army definition of combat power was exquisite. I thought it was perfect. The problem was people weren't choosing to use it. The other problem was we didn't have a forcing function for the Army as an institution because we hadn't been focused on Western combat operations for a while. So you start having conversations about combat power in terms of what constitute favorable force ratios. How do you even figure out what a force ratio is? So one of my guys showed me an article that Major wrote, I think his MMAS, last year. Maybe he's writing it now. But he talked about a U.S. light infantry division and a Chinese, whatever version of it, I think it's called a brigade or something. But just to figure out how you would attrit it down to get to a 3-1 ratio between a U.S. division and this brigade size formation, you'd have to attrit it like 60%. Whereas in the U.S. mine, a division's got 3 or 4 BCTs, it automatically has 3-1 combat power against that. So we've got some work as an Army to do. And this definition that we went to when we talk about firepower, mobility, protection, in particular, with information. Those are things that you can assign a numeric value to by, like, types of forces. And then you understand that leadership is that qualitative difference between the two. So you guys aren't probably old enough to play the old Avalon Hill war games because everything's digital now. But in the old days, you'd have cardboard counters and they had numbers in the corners. And usually it was your protection number or your survivability number. It was your firepower number, you had a range number on there, and then you had a qualitative or a speed number associated with that that told you your mobility. And that was how you could work the ratios and play your dice and all the rest of that. Well, that was the basis for the COFOs that were designed in the 80s to be with the Soviets because that fed the algorithms that went into the simulations, but it also helped you think through the old-fashioned acetate and counting units and then trying to do the math to figure out what's the order of the boss. So there's that. And then the wargaming. So We're open to suggestions. No, we are. I mean, we address wargaming, and we are. And if there's ways that we could do that, I would just tell you, my personal experience with wargaming is the inadequacies of the wargaming is generally due to the inadequacies of the people leading it. Wargaming is brutal, hard stuff, particularly at, say, the brigade and battalion level, because you don't have a lot of time, but if you don't get that right, you don't end up with a decision matrix that is very particularly useful. So you spend a lot of time on something that's not really worthwhile. And the only way to get good at it is to do it a lot. And you got to do it with the same team. And just the amount of hours spent, you know, on late at night, and even in a garrison environment in the 1990s, as you're getting ready to go either to a warfighter or somewhere else, just over and over and over. But eventually you get good at it, and it's less painful. But getting there is awful. And there's no way around. It's not something I don't think that you can easily automate, because there's too many subjective factors. And it's the subjective stuff that drags the war games out. That's what people end up arguing about. The other thing that drags war games out, back to the subject matter expertise piece, is if you depend upon the intel officer to tell you everything. On the blue side, it used to be a cultural norm in the U.S. Army that the expert on enemy armor was armor officers. The expert on artillery was artillery officers. Same thing with aviation, engineering capabilities, and so forth. Not the S2 or the G2. The S2 and the G2 knew most of that stuff up to a point, but their business was most likely most dangerous course of action, how's the enemy going to react, and so forth. And so if the intel officer has to explain to everybody, as you're doing the war game, why what you're doing, sir, is dumb, because you do understand what this thing can do to you, right? You don't have a high enough level of shared understanding to even have a good war game, because you haven't developed people who come to the war game prepared. And part of that preparation is understanding your threat counterpart by your branch warfighting function. So, again, another long answer to an easy question. We do take cards and letters from the field. Yeah, well, we do. You guys, you shouldn't be surprised with some of your predecessors about class of 2018, Sam's. It was rumbling in the ranks, and we could hear some of this stuff, and there were people like, "Mah." And, one of the things, for example, they said, "Hey, we think you guys, this FN3O on Lisco, boy, it's pretty good, but you're only going to use that against Iran, right?" I said, "What do you mean?" So, "Well, we would never fight conventional conflict against a nuclear armed opponent." And I'm going, what we didn't understand, which is why we didn't address it, was that we were a bunch of old guys, right? Relatively old guys who were commissioned at the tail end of the Cold War and conducting operations on a potentially nuclear battlefield. Is something that you prepare for. I mean, that was my second nature. I mean, the whole Cold War thing with the conventional forces, you know, 335,000 troops in Europe was about making sure they didn't just drive in and do what they want. So you have to be willing to fight. Well, we didn't explain that. Like, we didn't say, you know, it doesn't matter if somebody drops a tactical nuke on the core headquarters. The battle's not over. We're continuing to fight. And we've gotten, you know, significant feedback. And so, you know, one of the tenets of the FDL is account for being under continuous observation, because the larger idea is if you can be observed, you can be killed. It's like in a big call box. And that includes with tactical nuclear weapons or chemical attack, persistent or non-persistent. And we have adversaries that have that in their doctrine. So that was second. That was, again, a thing that I... So we were actually, when we worked this change one that we had planned to do anyways, we're going to not talk about things in terms of broad generalities and euphemisms like WMD. Right? We're going to say tactical nuclear weapons and persistent or non-persistent chemical weapons, because that's what we're talking about. So let's say what we're talking about. And, oh, by the way, we have to be able to continue the fight if part of the force is slimed or part of the force is atomized. So it's not over.
I think you bridged into that question we highlighted a little bit earlier, which is doctrine having this unique role, right? So theory is theory.
Sure.
History is what it is, or as it is defined by the victor. But doctrine's informed by those, right? Like, the arrows go from theory and history into the doctrine. Does your team choose what theory makes it in, or what history makes it in?
Yeah, so it's kind of like, we were joking about that too, because somebody said asked us that before. And who's your favorite theorist, and what do you what's informing your approach? And I said, we're Americans. We steal everybody's stuff, right? It's like restaurants. You know, we're Americans. We eat everything. We eat Thai. We eat Indian. We eat Mexican. In fact, we make it our own. Right? We eat it at our house. Right? I mean, we don't have to go out to have that stuff. We make all that kind of stuff in our own homes, because we take the best tasting stuff, the stuff we like, and we use it. That's exactly what we do with theory. We've got, I would tell you that this 3.0, the 2017 3.0 was explicitly causeless. And it was because we had framed it around the Army strategic roles. So it was about what's the purpose of the operation you're conducting, which is inherently causeless in construct. What's the nature of the conflict you're in? What's the purpose of it? It's a political act, and all those ideas. This time around, I would tell you it's a 50-50 balance of Sun Tzu, Clausewitz. There's obviously some Jomini in there. Math matters, right, in LISCO, as we have to remind people. You know, there are hard things that you can't get around. You can't hula your way through an amphibious assault if you don't have boats. Yeah, I know. There's certain things that, you know, are not going to get cured purely by saying we're going to have a mission command approach to this operation, right? You have to have ammunition. You've got to be able to move fuel. You've got to do those things. So, but I would tell you there's a balance somehow of those three in there. And we emphasize the ideas that we think people will understand the most clearly. So there's a bunch of Sun Tzu quotes in there. You saw the article we wrote. We just published in Military Review. We quote Patton on the Orchestra of Mars. I should remember that. But it's a musical.
Musicians
of Mars. Metaphor. But Sun Tzu does the same thing with colors. Right. And so we balanced both of those things. The reason why we didn't have a picture of Sun Tzu in there is people didn't want us to have a picture. So we... I think we steal shamelessly from all of the best ideas. And the other thing we try to do is provide examples without belaboring the theory explicitly. We like to use quotations. We like to use vignettes. And when you see somebody describe some idea in a pithy, enduring way that makes sense, you know, that holds up over time. And that's why we don't do quotations from living people. Like, you know, we're trying to pick ideas that have been enduring over time in terms of military professionals around the world. And so when you take that approach, you can help people visualize certain things that they haven't seen before, that the theory actually is informed in the past. For whatever reason, for some period of time, like 10 or 15 years, it was a policy against putting quotations and vignettes in doctrine. We said, that's madness. We are putting that back in because we are describing things that nobody's done. Or very few people still serve.
There's a very interesting thing I want to talk about for theorists, but I would do myself a disservice if I didn't plug. My stamps project this year, my monograph was coming out with an equation of how to evaluate combat power. So kind of steal from Duport a little bit there of having a theory of victory tied to a mathematical equation, kind of like Einstein, and just using like the elements of combat power times terrain versus a variable. So how you can use that at the game level, right? It's a thing that's fungible at the level that you can change it. But we had a really interesting question about theorists, and why does it feel like there's no modern theorists? It does feel like in the last, I don't know, 30 years, there's been enough pivotal turns in world dynamics that if you look back in history over 200 years, there should have been one or two people like raising their hands and go, hey, my theory of how the universe works is kind of changing. Maybe we need a new, maybe there's a paradigm shift, or one of our favorite terms for
instance. Not my favorite term.
Dr. P is going to really come after me for that one. But there hasn't been, right? There hasn't been at least anybody in the last 30 years has come out as a predominant theorist in, let's just call MDO, right? Or
yeah, so first of all, military theory is devised by people for people. And the one constant in the nature of war is a fundamental human endeavor, right? I mean, everyone says that all the time. But the reason why they emphasize it so much is it's true. And if you, in the Army in particular, but us in the Marine Corps especially, we conduct operations primarily on the land amidst populations to create the security conditions and military conditions of both for some sort of inventory and political outcome. Political outcomes are people, right? People make those decisions. So you either keep fighting or you don't keep fighting. That's a people decision, right? You're trying to set conditions to make them stop or to make them do what you want, but it's all about the people. And I think that's one of the reasons why there aren't that many different theories over time, because essentially they are captured or have captured to a very large extent the way people think about something that we've been doing since there's been people. So it's hard, I think, for someone to come along and say, I got a completely new way, because you can't discount all the other things. Because all the other things, to the extent that they've been accepted by people, is common knowledge or some other standard of military professionalism. Okay, I'm not going to ever get rid of those things, so what's the new thing? So you brought up cyber space. So Lieutenant Joe Lundy and I were, he's a great guy, and if you ever get a chance to have him on for one of these, or to come over to San Jose, you should have him. And we were talking about Operation Blue Crank and the role of space in cyber. And it was really interesting because whenever there's a new thing, there's huge champions for it. This is changing the world, right? You know, in many cases, it has changed the world. But its impact on, in terms of military things, does it change the operations you're conducting? Does it change the way you conduct operations, or does it allow you to do things that you already do better? And when it allows you to do something different, it tends to affect doctrine. If it's just letting you do the same thing, better, faster, shoot further, or whatnot, it may impact a few things, but it doesn't really affect the big ideas. So when you talk about space and cyber, what does space actually get you? Well, it's continuous observation, right, from a relative sanctuary, if as long as an adversary decides that they're not going to conduct space warfare. But it's basically an enabler. And it enables communications, it enables information collection, dissemination. It can enable electromagnetic attack, perhaps. And maybe it'll be lasers. But, or, you know, some form of WMD that allows you to escape detection and all that. But those, what it does, doesn't fundamentally change warfare. It increases the number of considerations you have in the tools in the toolbox. Cyber is even more interesting in some ways. Because I would characterize the cyberspace operations in the context of the Russian-Ukraine war is it's almost in a World War I stage. So we went through the opening sequences that are extremely dynamic, right? There's massive cyber attacks and, you know, lots of disruptions and all that. And then you react, you do countermeasures. And so now you almost have a trench warfare kind of approach where there are probes and there are the occasional big offensives and those kinds of things. But none of them are decisive, because it's the outcome on the ground that's decisive. And so, cyber is again a name. You collect and you disseminate information, and you can do things to people's systems that have physical effects. But that theory always balances the human, the physical, and the information dimensions, right? I mean, Clausewitz does that himself in his own way. So does Sun Tzu. And does so does Boyd. So, you know, again, when you steal from all of those things, you're not leaving a lot of space for something else. What you do, though, allow is, back to the original topic of your discussion, Operation R, it gives you a lot more possibilities in terms of devising operational approaches. An operational artist is familiar with what space can do and what cyber can do, as well as maritime. And we don't talk about that. But the last time, you know, for the history of the U.S. Army up to 1945, our sister service was the Navy. And it's been about that long since they were our sister service in the sense of the operation we were conducting, right? But I would offer that with an Indo-PACOM focus, we have to have the same relationship with the United States Navy that we've had with the U.S. Air Force since the Cold War. And we got to get moving on that pretty quick. And it's got to work both ways. But an operational artist at Indo-PACOM has got to understand maritime consideration, naval considerations, to a much greater degree than anybody has in the Cold War.
Yeah, we're doing an exercise with MSTP right now. Marines are over helping us do some stuff.
Sure.
But there's a lot of Marine Navy stuff in there. Dan and I independently went home and watched Master and Commander last night to get smart on it.
Yeah. Rewatched. It's been a classic.
Nobody attack us. It's at least 10, 12 watches a piece.
At least.
Best openings. But sir, I really appreciate the conversation. Thanks for your time. Do you have anything, kind of closing words or a call out, or you want to remind people that reading doctrine is important?
Yeah.
I'll tell them first. You can just explain.
Yeah, well, I mean, what is expected of you as a military professional is to be familiar with the doctrines relative to your job. Right? And the more you can study before you get to your next job, the better. But the other thing is the quality of our doctrine is entirely dependent on the quality of people that review it, provide inputs to it. And so my merry band of about 40 people writing stuff for a million-person army and then the other 150 people across TRADOC that do it are not the be-all, end-all subject matter experts on the world. The people out in the operational force that are doing these things every day are the current subject matter experts, or the closest thing we have to it. And so what we would ask is, if you're reading something that doesn't make sense, reach out to us and fight for an opportunity to review the pubs that get sent on a routine basis for review. We typically assign that to some assistant staff guy somewhere just to meet the requirement, and they just tell us where we have problems and queries out of us. Seldom do the busiest people, the most experienced people, the G3s, the G5s, the planners, and the commanders, have the time to sit there and look at it. So we're missing the benefits of that level of experience unless we take special measures to do it. And so I would just ask people that, you know, as you read stuff, be a critical thinker and then come back to us. Because, again, I gave you an example earlier, but there are things that make perfectly good sense to us that may not make sense to some people in the current force, and we need to explain it. It's our fault if the doctrine is not understood. Now, it's not our fault if you don't read it. There's a difference between the two. Right. So that's my sales pitch.
This has been an official publication of the School of Advanced Military Studies. The views and expressions heard here are those of the authors and do not reflect the official position or opinions of SAMS, the U.S. Army, or the U.S. government. Stay up to date on all things SAMS and the Operational Arch by following us on Twitter at US_SAMS. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to or follow the podcast. Additionally, if you have recommendations for an episode, send any proposals to operationalarch@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.